This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for cool jazz, an exploration of musical outreach programs, or a junior performance of a classic 1960s musical, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Saxophonist, composer, and jazz educator Tony DeGrotte is one of New Orleans' most creative and accomplished musicians. The band he started in the late 1970s, Astral Project, has won international acclaim for spirited performances of their mostly original repertoire. And they remain one of the Crescent City's most respected musical ensembles. Tony DeGrotte, who grew up in Summit, New Jersey, about 35 miles outside of New York City, recently sat down with WWNO's Fred Kasten for a Talkin' Jazz interview at the old U.S. Mint. They began the conversation talking about how Tony DeGrotte made his way to New Orleans in 1977.
I was living in Boston, took a gig on the road. I was about 23, 24 at the time, and I didn't want to go back to Boston when that tour ended, so I thought I'd visit New Orleans and see what was here.
That was with Archie Bell and the Grills.
You know everything, don't you? Yeah, that was with Archie Bell from Houston, Texas.
Now, can you still do the Tighten Up?
Only in my dreams.
So is it dreams or nightmares?
Well, I take pills for that.
All right. Were you a kid that got involved with music early on?
I was. We had a good music program in my school system, and for some reason, when I was about 14, I just zoned in on jazz.
Had you been playing for a while when that happened?
I had been playing. I owned or I was renting a saxophone to be in the school music program, but I was probably more interested in baseball at the time.
Before you kind of got interested in at 14 in jazz, had you experienced any of it either on radio or
no?
Live?
I was totally oblivious. I did not know what it was. One thing that was once I heard it, I just heard something, and I think it was a Horace Silver tune, The Preacher.
Oh, yeah.
It was a very specific tune. And I said, wow, that's really great. There was a tenor saxophone solo. And I just said, that's great. I want to do that. Was at a particularly critical time when I had to either give the instrument back to the school or buy one of my own instruments. And I said, my dad said, are you going to practice if I buy you an instrument? And I said, yeah, if you buy me a tenor, I'll practice.
So that happened?
Yeah, that all happened. And it was the last day of seventh grade.
So did you practice that summer?
All, every day. When you're learning jazz, you know, I teach jazz every day now at Loyola University. When you teach, one of the most important things to do is to listen to recordings of, you know, established jazz masters. And what you do is you transcribe their improvised solos. So you try to either write it down or learn it through the air. And recreate it on your instrument. That is really the best way to learn jazz. There's lots of books and lots of different techniques and so forth, but that is the source, and that's really has all the information you need to know. And so I didn't know that. Nobody told me that at that time, but I immediately started doing that. I started writing down and learning solos, and what I did was I also was interested in big bands because I went to see Thad Jones, Mel Lewis at the Vanguard. I saw Duke Ellington's band. I saw Count Basie's band playing, you know, in and around Manhattan. So big bands were very interesting to me at the time, and I tried to transcribe the entire big band. And you know that takes a certain kind of technique when you hear a big band, the trumpets are doing something, the saxes are doing another thing, trombones are doing another thing, and together they sound great. So you have to. There's lots of little techniques and lots of little arranging devices that you can use. And I didn't know any of that. I just tried to write down what I was hearing, and so that led to me wanting to know more, and that led to the piano instructions.
You had, just using your knowledge of reading music that you had picked up in your schools, were trying to make these notations.
Yeah, actually, I wasn't that good of a reader, and much less a writer. But in this process of transcribing, that helped me to become a much, much better reader. And but then after that, I was pretty a diligent practicer, and I got my little basics together.
Now, as you got into the eighth grade and you had been practicing all summer, was there something that were someplace in the system there where you could play jazz?
Yeah, we had a school. It was called a stage band, and that's the educational description of a big band. You know, right. So if any of you seen a big band like Duke Ellington or Count Basie or any kind of big band, that's what they called it in the school system, stage bands. And we had one, and it was quite good. It was the perfect thing for me. And I really enjoyed playing in that. That was the only jazz program in the school, anything close to jazz. There wasn't any improvisation class or anything like that. But I really enjoyed the big band, and I tried to write for it. I immediately started trying to write things out for it. And I actually have some recordings from way back in 1968, 67, and they sound pretty good.
These were your transcriptions or originals?
No, these were original things that I wanted to try to write. Some original compositions, some were arrangements on standard tunes, but you know, each time I got interested in something, it led to another layer of something I had to learn.
So you began composing pretty quickly after playing.
I did. It was, and that's part of the process. You know, if you think of jazz artists, that's what we do when we pick up our instruments. We're basically composing in the moment. So anything that you study about composition, if you study Beethoven, if you study Bach, you study different forms in classical theory. It's all the same. Everything that applies, everything that's an organizing factor for Beethoven or the Beatles is the same thing in jazz. And but the only difference is in jazz you're doing it spontaneously in the moment. So you have to understand what composition is, what makes a good composition, and then you have to develop technique on your instrument, and then you put it all together and hopefully you can come up with something in the moment.
After a couple of years at the Berklee School of Music in Boston, Tony DeGrande entered an intense period of jazz rehearsal and listening.
That was it for me. When I started listening to Coltrane, I couldn't listen to anybody else. So, I mean, I really just listened to him pretty nonstop for a couple of years. And I would, you know, veer off and listen to other saxophonists, you know, Sonny and Dexter and Charlie Parker and everybody else, but nobody hit me like Coltrane did. So a lot of what I do, you know, as a saxophonist comes out of that influence.
Another big Boston influence on Tony DeGrande, New Orleans native trumpeter and bandleader Stanton Davis.
And he was actually probably the very first person I ever met from New Orleans, and I really admired his playing. He was a great trumpeter. And he had a band that I was, I thought it was the best band in Boston. It was called Ghetto, Stanton Davis and Ghetto Mysticism. Mm. And just the way he ran the band, he definitely brought New Orleans influences. And it was a funk band, sort of in the line along the lines of, you know, Miles Davis fusion kind of thing.
Right.
But really good, really exciting. When I first came here in 1977, 78, that was in the back of my mind to start a group that would be the place that I could be my most artistic. I definitely was thinking about Stanton and Ghetto Mysticism.
Ghetto Mysticism.
Tony DeGrande did start that group, Astro Project, and 35 years later, they are still together and still playing great. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Caston.
Today's Tony DeGrande interview was made possible in part by the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park, which presents the Talkin' Jazz with Fred Caston interview series the last Friday of each month at the Old U.S. Mint. The series continues with Fred's interview of cornetist Connie Jones this Friday afternoon at 2. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Music education delivered by our region's professional orchestra, the LPO, is helping young students tap their own creative potential. Writer Ian McNulty, who produces WWNO's Community Impact Series, has more.
Kate Withrow first picked up the violin at age 5. But those early lessons didn't always go so well for the precocious youngster. In fact, she remembers
throwing temper tantrums and everything. It was terrible. And I hated it for the first 7 years. I hated practicing, and I never wanted to practice. And then eventually it became, you know, I developed like a sense of ownership over it.
It was a connection she felt to the music's history and tradition, melded with her own personal expression. She continued to study the violin through college. She found acclaim for her performances, and eventually she went pro. She's now a section violinist for the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, the LPO. Withrow is also head of the LPO's Education Committee, and it's in this role that she helps give today's young students the opportunities that so profoundly influenced her life.
You know, once you get to that moment and once you see that moment in another student, it's just magical. And I think that's what we're all in this business for, whether it's jazz music or classical music, anything. It's that moment of creation.
These moments are made possible for school children across a 12-parish region around New Orleans, thanks to a far-reaching education initiative from the LPO. The orchestra hosts more than 30 educational concerts through the year, and it provides teachers' guides and lesson plans to help educators tie in the musical experiences with grade-level curriculum goals.
This is where I really see our musicians and our orchestra as a resource to help them. You know, what can we do to help you guys do what you really want or need in your school?
That's Amanda Worslin, the LPO's education director. She points to the orchestra's Early Explorers program, where students from pre-K to first grade get to check out individual instruments up close, followed by a concert designed just for them around themes like colors or animals or the alphabet, themes they recognize from their classroom brought to life through music. Then there's the LPO's Young People's Concerts, where the students themselves are invited to play with the orchestra.
We've had a big spike in our attendance, actually, because it's a much more engaging process when the kids are playing along with the orchestra. Like, I'm playing with the LPO today. I'm so excited.
Will some of these students be inspired to follow Kate Withrow's example and pursue a classical music career? Maybe. But Withrow herself feels the potential impact of music education like this is much broader.
Everybody talks about Steve Jobs and how he took the daring to make something that nobody thought was possible. That takes a creative skill that is lacking in our educational system right now. And ideally, the arts, you know, pursuing an instrument or learning about music at its best does that for a child. It teaches the child that they can do something that they thought was impossible. They can play a song and make it red or blue or yellow or make it sound like an elephant or make up something themselves, improvise, compose something themselves, and see that they can actually be a creator in this world.
Learn more about the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra's education outreach programs at wwno.org. For WWNO, I'm Ian McNulty.
The Community Impact Series is made possible with support from the Greater New Orleans Foundation. It's an exciting summer for the arts and for young people participating in musical theater intensives and a performing arts conservatory being offered by JPAS, the Jefferson Performing Arts Society. The youngsters are gearing up for the opening of Bye Bye Birdie this weekend. And joining me now to talk about it all is JPAS Executive Director Dennis Asaf. Welcome to the program.
Honored to be here.
There is a big focus on summer youth opportunities at JPAS. Tell us about the musical theater intensives that are going on right now.
We used to call them summer music camps, but they really evolved into much more than just a camp where the kids come and, hey, let's put on a show. We renamed it a summer music intensive because it is, quite frankly, a very intense rehearsal period and performance period. It's amazing what these young people can accomplish in only really 2 weeks of solid rehearsal, and the third week is what we call tech week. We're actually running the show with all the elements, the costumes, the sound. All the kids are mic'd. We have a live orchestra putting in all the costumes and the scenery and lighting, etc. It's amazing how these young minds can absorb all of that and produce a really fine show in 3 weeks.
And these youngsters are what ages?
Third through seventh grade.
Wow.
And then, of course, we have the high school conservatory.
And the staff. Who are the people that are teaching?
We bring in guest master teachers who are local as well as national experts in their field. We have a guy from Los Angeles coming in, Henry Layton, who is an expert in stage combat, working with the kids. And we're very proud of our JPAS babies who have come through our program who are now performing on Broadway. Casey Lee Thompson is with Legally Blonde. She came in and did a seminar on choreography. We've got David Bologna coming in. David was in Broadway and actually won a Tony Award with his company for Billy Elliot. David is a Katrina refugee now living in Austin, Texas. So we're bringing him in to share his experiences. And this is what the conservatory is all about.
Now, the youngest group,
yep,
they are gearing up for the weekend opening of Bye Bye Birdie.
Bye Bye Birdie, yes.
Tell us about this classic.
Well, it was written in 1960 and actually won the Tony Award that year for Best Musical. It starred Dick Van Dyke and Cheetah Rivera. It's a fun show, completely wholesome, all about Conrad Birdie, a draft dodger, appealed it three times, but he eventually gets drafted. And the crux of the story is they're trying to get him on Ed Sullivan's show, and they're having a contest to be the first girl to give him his last kiss before he ships off for Germany. Much like Elvis Presley.
How did you come to choose this for the younger set?
That's always the challenge because we have about 60 children in the camp, and we try to pick shows that have lots of characters, exciting dancing, big chorus ensembles, so we want every child to have as much stage time as possible. It'll appeal to the parents as well.
And these young people that are in the intensive training in the arts, they're also taking away life lessons in the process.
Exactly. You know, when you get a bunch of kids together who have never met each other before, and they become characters in a play, they have to learn lines, they have to deliver those lines to the public as well as to each other. They have to learn a dance together. They have to learn a song and be able to do all of that to an audience, most of whom they've never met before. That creates a lot of confidence in a child. Now, these kids may never become performing artists, but what they will become is a confident adult who can go into a boardroom and give a presentation and not worry about how they sound or how they stand because they've been nurtured in a confident way.
That's a lot that these children are learning, are absorbing, and producing.
Yeah. Nothing gives me greater pride. We got a young man now, Sawyer Nunez, who was one of the seven children in Sound of Music that we did 3 years ago. Brilliant little kid. This young man is now in the cast of Matilda on Broadway. He's 11 years old.
That's incredible.
So we call them JPAS babies, and I just burst with pride.
Now, your 36th season is just around the corner.
Yes.
What can we look forward to?
It's going to be an exciting season, albeit somewhat different. Hurricane Isaac knocked out our Westwego Performing Arts Theater. So we're moving much of our season next door to the Westwego Performing Arts Theater in the little theater we call Teatro Wego. And we've got some really fun things. The first thing to kick it off is we're doing a New Orleans jukebox musical, world premiere. Butch Kerr, one of our directors who won Best Director of Light in the Piazza, has written the show called Blueberry Hill. And it takes place in a Ninth Ward or Seventh Ward bar, typical New Orleans neighborhood. And there are two white folks and five African Americans in it. It's a poignant story. It infuses all of the great Irma Thomas, Lloyd Price, Fats Domino, the Dixie Cups, all these songs that I grew up with. I don't know how old you are. Maybe you are familiar with some of them. Butch has written a fun and clever story interspersed with the action, the story, if you will, are one fun classic New Orleans rhythm and blues song after the other.
Wow.
So we're going to premiere that in September. We're going to take it to the North Shore as well. We're going to do 5 weeks of performances of it. Then we have another show called A Perfect Wedding. The groom is getting married on Saturday. Friday night, he goes into a bar for his bachelor party, gets all torn up, goes to bed, and wakes up in bed with a strange woman in his bridal suite. And then it becomes one chaotic farce after the other. Then we're doing another thing. It's a kind of an audience improv show called Murder at the Cafe Noir. We're doing A Tuna Christmas. We're doing Nutcracker again with Ballet Heisel at East Jefferson Auditorium in December. And privately, I'm lighting candles and I'm saying novenas that somehow miraculously our new performing arts center on Airline will be finished just enough that we can get and perform Nutcracker in there. No promises. Nobody's told me anything. But I'm lighting candles and doing novenas that somehow we can get that in there. But I would like to tell you that we have the rights to do The Color Purple, Shrek, and Les Mis, and a world premiere opera by composer Daniel Shore, who's on the faculty at Xavier. And it's about the Freedom Rides of the 60s. The brave young men and women who rode down on those buses to Mississippi and Alabama to get the voting rights going there. We're also going to be doing another world premiere by our composer in residence, Glenn Bailey, about the conquering of Mount Everest called Mountain of Dreams.
That's quite a lot to be excited about.
Well, we are.
Sounds like a fantastic season awaits
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Dennis, thanks so much for stopping by.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Diane.
Dennis Assaf, Executive Director of the Jefferson Performing Arts Society. Bye Bye Birdie opens this weekend with performances Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. More info at jpas.org. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'm Diane Mack.